Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
Thank you. You may be seated. Welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. We have a packed courtroom today, I see. We do have one case set for oral argument, as you know, because you're here. Before we get started, I'll introduce the panel that we've got today. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right, Justice Mike Wallach, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So we're delighted that y'all are here. We're looking forward to oral argument, and I will ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Valero Corp versus Christie. May it please the court, Mr. John Bash will argue for appellants, and Mr. Jason Wright will argue for appellees.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, John Bash for Appellant Bolero. We're asking the court to reverse the trial court's grant of the motion to dismiss under the TCPA and as a result vacate the award of attorney's fees against our client. Now, I hope the audience count in the room does not give the impression that this case is not important, because it is. It raises a question of first impression under the TCPA, and in particular under an amendment that the legislature enacted in 2019.
But before you even get to that amendment, I noticed that you had a footnote in your brief about DeAngelis, and in a diplomatic sort of way, suggesting that perhaps that case was incorrectly decided. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on that.
I can, Your Honor. So the definition of legal action in the TCPA requires, and I'm going to not get the quote exactly right, but it requires an action that seeks legal or equitable relief. And our submission would be, at least if DeAngelis wasn't on the books, that a deposition is not what's meant by legal or equitable relief. If you look at that part of the DeAngelis opinion, which of course had a number of holdings that were not challenging, it talked about how the 202 procedure is similar to a bill of equity. There wasn't a lot of analysis that explained exactly why it was legal or equitable relief. We think a lot of the maybe peculiarities in a case like this stem possibly from the fact that maybe this wasn't intended to be a legal action within the meaning of the TCPA.
Do you see anything? I know that there's been a lot of talk on the non-disparagement aspect of this in the 2019 amendments to the TCPA, but the legislature also amended the definition of legal action. It didn't explicitly say anything about 202 proceedings, but do you think that there's anything?
When we were preparing our arguments, I looked briefly at that. I didn't think that amendment, and it broadened the definition a little bit, but I can't remember exactly the language difference. I didn't think it affected this issue, which is really focused on a deposition is not legal or equitable relief. In our view. Of course, the court reached the opposite determination. It has the ability, I think, to review prior precedents, at least on bank, and maybe reconsider them. But I'll turn now, if I would, to our
principal submissions
in the case. So really, we think there's two reasons, each sufficient by themselves, to reverse the decision below. The first is that this action falls within the exemption we were just discussing for an action that seeks to enforce a non-disparagement agreement. That's at section 27.010A5B. The second is that even if it doesn't fall within the exemption, in this case, we at least made out a prima facie case that could allow a rational jurist to conclude that the benefits of an investigatory deposition outweigh the costs.
How can a jurist determine that sort of question when 70% of the alleged contract has been redacted?
Well, Your Honor, two responses to that. First, in order to fall, most of their arguments on the redaction, I think, have fallen under the first argument, which is the exemption. So we've addressed those in our brief. This is an action that seeks to enforce a non-disparagement clause. Whether that clause is valid or there might be exceptions that apply, we submit it's not something that a court determines at that initial stage when it's just deciding, is this an action to enforce a non-disparagement agreement? That's about the character of the action. With respect to the benefits and burdens of the deposition, Your Honor, they have not raised the argument that the redactions are relevant to that. I'm just thinking in real time through the question. We certainly contend that there's a non-disparagement agreement. We've provided the parts of the agreement that show her signature, that show she agrees there was consideration, and that she...
But we don't know what anything else is. How are we supposed to know whether what the benefits are to be gained if we don't know what the entire contract is?
Well, I think the court has enough to know that there's at least a good faith basis for a claim that she violated a non-disparagement provision. And that's because the parts that are not redacted include her signature, the avowal of both parties that there was consideration, and the non-disparagement clause. So that's one. Two, Ms. Frisbee had the opportunity in the court below, if she thought that some of the confidential sections redacted were important to the case, were relevant to the benefit and burdens analysis, she could have asked for a filing under seal.
But that's your burden, though, isn't it?
It's our burden to...
Why should she write, if she thinks you haven't met your burden, why should she be adding to it?
Well, we do think we've met our burden, and let me go into that, Your Honor.
I know that you think you do. My question is, if they don't believe that you've met your burden, one of the decisions they have to make is to whether to open that door and maybe fill the gap, or just let the gap there and see what happens.
That's true. They can make that decision. And what I would say, Your Honor, is that parties frequently submit sealed filings in the course of litigation in order to protect confidential information, privacy, and so forth.
But is a sealed filing is different from a redacted document offered into evidence, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor, but if the other side believed that there was relevant material in that redacted document, they could have acted. And I think it would be an unwise rule to hold that a 202 petitioner that's investigating the potential breach of a contract that may have very confidential information in it can't submit a redacted filing, subject, of course, to the other side coming and saying, hey, we'd like you to submit that under seal.
Well, just picking up with what you started with, you could submit an unredacted finding and then have it sealed, couldn't you?
We could, Your Honor. We did not do that in this case. And I would just note, Your Honor, that the other side did not raise below the argument that the redactions meant the benefit and burden analysis should come out differently.
If it's your burden, why would they have to?
Well, it's just not an argument they raised for why the benefits and burdens are wrong. I'm not saying that they had the burden to produce evidence, but typically when we make arguments in favor of an outcome, in this case, that the benefits of an investigative deposition outweigh the burdens, we don't have to refute every conceivable counterargument that someone could raise. They're supposed to come and join issue and say, well, wait a minute, the benefits don't outweigh the burdens because we don't know what the contract says. They didn't raise that argument below. They raised it. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But the benefits and burdens that Rule 202 speaks of, don't you have to have clear and specific evidence that you're going to get some information out of a deposition that outweigh you've got to have evidence of what the burden is on the potential deponent. Isn't it more than just saying, well, here's a contract and we want to talk to her and see how she violated it, if she did?
It is, Your Honor. So let me go through what I think the evidence that we submitted is that shows this case falls within the heartland of a case where we don't have overwhelming evidence that she violated the contract, but we don't have no evidence either. We have just enough evidence that an investigation would actually be quite helpful. So one is the contract that we've discussed, redacted. Two is her affirmation from 2017. So that was something that she signed, was provided to us in conjunction with a settlement demand, and it has a number of quotes that do not reflect well on Bolero if they're true. Of course, the company disputes them.
And that was provided to the trial court?
That was provided to the trial court. Third, and this was also provided to the trial court, we have these CNBC articles that arise in 2023, and as we've shown in the reply brief through highlights, they track verbatim the quotes in this 2017 affirmation. Our submission is that if she transmitted those or was involved in the transmission to CNBC, that would be a breach of her non-disparagement obligation. And so we think that has created a fair inference that she was involved, but it's certainly not conclusive. So this is that case that falls right in the middle. We're actually being able to sit down before we file a full-fledged lawsuit, sue anyone for damages, and just say, what happened? Were you involved in this? Did someone come to you and say, can I send this to the media? Did you send it to the media? If not, and those answers seem credible, we might take one set of options.
Did she not already deny that?
She denied it, Your Honor, in a declaration under penalty of perjury, but not sworn in this case. But as the court knows, there's a reason parties in civil litigation want depositions, not just signed affidavits from people, in order to scrutinize, ask follow-up questions, and, you know, determine to their satisfaction whether the person's statement is accurate. So that's why we want a deposition. That's why there's that procedure. Otherwise, the state Supreme Court would have said, you know, just get an affidavit in every case. You don't need the 202 deposition process. So those are, to us, the principal benefits. We're not sure that she violated the provision, but there's at least reason to think she might have, given that her quotes are now verbatim in a CNBC article. So we'd like to ask her about those. Your Honor, Justice Kerr asked about the burden side of the equation. So I think we put in evidence of everything we could possibly know about the burden. So we said we'll cover certain costs. We obviously did not agree to cover her attorney's fees. That's fair to be considered as part of the balance. But she's raised in the documents that she produced in the trial court idiosyncratic harms. She lives in terror of this and so forth. That couldn't be something that the 202 petitioner has to bring forward, because there's no way we could know her idiosyncratic reaction to having to be deposed. And the other thing I'd say about this, Your Honor, is that the question at this stage, because this is just up on the TCPA motion, is not whether the benefits outweigh the burdens. That's for the trial court to decide. This court denied a writ of mandamus challenging that conclusion. The only question is whether a rational person, or whether a person could draw a rational inference that the benefits outweigh the burdens. That's the TCPA standard. It's designed to weed out totally meritless lawsuits that target speech. It's not designed for a, you know, a fresh determination of the question. So what we'd submit is that we think we've satisfied that burden. And even if every member of the panel would think, I don't think the benefits outweigh the burdens in this case, we've at least allowed a rational inference that they do. And that should mean we're not subjected to fee shifting and so forth. Maybe we lose on the merits, but the TCPA should not apply. I'll address one more point on the benefits and burdens and then turn back to the exemption if I could. And the only other point I would make is that they've raised the possibility that we should have deposed CNBC. And I've been involved in litigation before where you're trying to seek a source from a media organization. It's very resource intensive and time consuming. And in most jurisdictions, the general rule is you're supposed to seek the information from somebody else first, at least, before you go to the news organization and try to get a confidential source. And that's exactly what we did here. We went to the party that appears to be the source, certainly the original source of the statements, and sought to depose her. It would have been far more burdensome on the courts had we sought to depose CNBC.
Would you agree that, you know, in reading the transcripts, that I think Mr. Griffin, Archer Griffin, with your firm, he didn't actually specifically make that argument to the trial court? Do you agree with that?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
So I'll turn now in the 3 minutes I have left in my opening presentation to the exemption question, unless the court would like to focus on other topics. On the exemption issue, they've raised essentially three arguments. Two are case-specific, and I do not think have merit. Well, I don't think any of them have merit, but I'll just go through the two case-specific ones quickly. First, they say this does not arise from an employee-employer relationship. This action does not arise from an employee-employer relationship. Well, it's based on statements she made based on her observations as an employee. It's based on a severance agreement that released claims that she might have had arising out of her employment and imposing certain obligations on what she could do with information she gleaned from her employment. So we think it clearly arises from an employer-employee relationship. They also say there's no consideration for the agreement, or because of the redactions, we don't know what was in the agreement. One, as I mentioned earlier, I don't think for the exemption we need to actually prove the validity of the agreement. It's enough to say this is an action that seeks to enforce a non-disparagement agreement. It's just the character of the action. It's not a requirement that a court litigate merits defenses at that stage. And we also don't think they raised that argument below, and so it would be waived. The last point, and the one that has, I think, broader applicability across the state, is whether this is an action that seeks to enforce a non-disparagement agreement insofar as it ultimately just seeks a deposition, not the actual legal and equitable relief. And we would say it is for really three principal reasons. First, this court in DeAngelis and the Supreme Court in cases like DePino and Wolf have said that a 202 deposition is not an end in itself, it's ancillary to the anticipated suit. And they said that even when a party was proceeding under the investigative prong, not under the anticipated prong. That's DePino. So we think it picks up the purpose of the ultimate suit for purposes of the exemptions. Two, if you just think about the term enforcement in general parlance, It usually, in legal terminology, includes the process of investigation. We've given the example of law enforcement, and I think even my friend cited a brief a decision in the Supreme Court, Best versus Harper, that was an interpreting enforcement in a different provision and said the Black's Law Dictionary definition of this is the act or process of enforcing. And we would submit the investigation deposition as part of the process of enforcing. The last point we would make, and maybe this is the overarching one, is that there just doesn't seem to be much of a rational reason that the legislature would have said, you're seeking injunctive relief, damages, you're doing a full-fledged action to enforce the non-exemption provision, no problem, not subject to the TCPA, no fee shifting, even if it's meritless. We don't want that included. But if you're merely seeking the pre-suit deposition for the exact same potential claim, fee shifting, higher burden, it just doesn't make sense to us that the legislature rationally would have drawn that distinction that way. With that, Your Honor, unless there are further questions at this time, I'll reserve the remainder.
Doesn't that give you some clue as to the fact that a Rule 202 deposition may not be a legal action under the TCPA because it's not enforcing anything?
Justice, we think that's the most elegant and probably the correct solution to the issue in this case. Of course, DeAngelis is on the books, so we defer to the court's wise discretion on how to deal with that.
Thank you very much.
I'll before you even get started, I'll start off with a question.
Oh boy.
If this court were to essentially overrule DeAngelis and say that we believe that TCPA doesn't apply to 202 petitions, would you agree that essentially you're dead in the water on this case? Would you agree with that?
Well, I would not agree I'm dead in the water because I still have a right to appeal to the Texas Supreme Court. Yeah. But I think if you made that ruling to start with, yes, as far as at this stage.
Right. And of course you have the other, I mean, they're not even appealing the denial. They're just appealing the TCPA piece.
And I would point out too that the legal action point they brought up in a footnote, they did not raise that into the trial court. I think they would have had to raise that to the trial court to even bring it to you. But so I plan to focus on the exemption to start with. That's what I figured that they would be most interested in and that you're interested in. But if you're not interested in that, tell me to move right along. But so for me, there's two points I think are dispositive on the TCPA exemption we're talking about. And the first is that the Rule 202 petition that they filed actually sought two different things. Now, they said that they sought pre-suit discovery to look at did she breach non-disparagement. They also put on the face of their petition, though, that they were trying to undermine, essentially, attack her testimony for purposes of this other lawsuit that they're looking at from some New York attorney and 70-plus EEOC persons. So that is, on its face, right outside of the TCPA exemption. The second one is, even if they had only sought to invest...
So why can't they depose her as part of that other lawsuit?
Absolutely. They absolutely can do that. I don't think they should be trying to do it here by purposes of Rule 202. I think that's incorrect for the purposes of Rule 202 in Texas, which is broader than, as far as I know, broader than any other state, and it allows you to also do investigation, not only anticipated suits. But yeah, that's the point I'd make with that as well.
It, in this vein, you know, there, in your briefing, there's this whole thing about costs and benefits, and then of course, the other side has made the point that, you know, if they could have just filed suit, and that would be much more costly to your client. And then you kind of, in a roundabout way, argue that's not necessarily the case. I mean, do you at least concede that one of the purposes of having 202 in the books in the first place is to essentially add to judicial efficiency, to prevent unnecessary litigation? That's what 202 is for.
I understand what you're saying. I don't necessarily agree with the characterization that it's a more efficient process or it was intended for that. I think it was actually intended for some very specific limited situations. Number one being, if you have an anticipated suit, if someone's about to die, for example, you need to go depose that person before you have time to file a suit and depose them. That's one thing you can do. The investigatory purposes of it is, as far as I know, Texas is the only one that actually has that there. And the reason for it is the way I've always explained it to my clients, because I've used it before myself, is, for example, if you had an accident out on the street.
Yeah, you put that in your brief.
Yeah, so you've seen that point, where you just don't know any idea, like, I need to figure out who to sue, because you can't go in Texas and sue an anonymous person. Well, you can in certain instances, but you can't just sue a doe, right? So you need to figure out even who to sue. And I would point out here in their petition, he says they didn't know if she made these statements or not. There's actually, and I could point to you, I know I did in my brief, but I can find it for you, in their petition where they actually said she breached non-disparagement. She disclosed this to them. She already said, they already pled that she did it. And so they already have, under DeAngelis, that's one point under that case where they said, well, if you already have enough evidence to believe that you can say that, you don't need Rule 202. You need to go ahead and go file your lawsuit.
Well, I mean, never mind. I won't. It's okay. Move forward.
So the other second point on the exemption is this is really just a statutory construction problem, right? Because the TCPA statute itself says that you have to liberally construe it to protect the things that it was intended to protect. It actually has, I think there's a Texas Supreme Court case that says this is interesting about this statute. It not only says how you're supposed to construe it, but it also gives you the purposes of the statute. Very few statutes do that. And so it has to be construed liberally to effectuate its purpose. It says the purpose is to safeguard constitutional rights to petition, speak freely, associate freely, participate in government to the maximum extent possible. So that's why you see courts, when they're looking at a TCPA exemption, they say, we construe that very narrowly, because you start with already an exemption. It's just carving out something that's already agreed to be under the TCPA. And here, I don't think there's any question that this case falls under the TCPA to start. They didn't dispute that in the court below. They don't dispute it here as well. The statute, I think, exists for cases just like this. Here we have a huge company going after a former employee in retaliation for what she witnessed 7 years ago, which was some pretty awful discrimination that she reports anyway, against older workers and women, and she communicated it in the form of an affidavit for a legal proceeding. That's the only thing she did. That's a blatant attack on constitutional rights. So the only question is whether this new exemption, did the legislature really intend to pull them outside of that and allow them to do whatever they want? I think the rule of construction that says that these exemptions are narrowly construed is dispositive, because if you look at their arguments on the exemption, they're essentially saying that, you know, there's policy reasons as to why we think, you know, it's more efficient and we should not have this difference between Rule 202 and other cases. Those are all policy arguments. They're making different interpretations, and like with the contract, when you have two or more interpretations, that by definition is an ambiguity. Here, you don't have to, as a trial court would in a normal case, try to figure out what the parties intended. The legislature already told you. They said, we essentially instruct you to send it back default to the TCPA applies when there's any question. So I think that is kind of dispositive of all of their arguments, because they're not really, they can't deny what the face of the statute says. They're just trying to say, well, there might be a better policy if we applied it a different way. Now, that's not to suggest there's any ambiguity. I don't think there is at all. It's very clear. It says it applies only when you seek to enforce a non-disparagement provision arising from employment. You cannot enforce or seek to enforce a contract by Rule 202 petition for pre-suit discovery. You just can't do that. And they agree with that, because if you look at their reply brief on page 15, I'll read, it says, although Frisbee is correct that a Rule 202 petition cannot seek relief beyond discovery. That is the very point, I think. They go on to make some arguments about different ways to construe those words, right? But again, you have the rule of construction that says if there's any ambiguity here, any doubt, we're going to default back to the TCPA applies. And I think it's, to me, it really is kind of obvious, though, that the drafters did recognize that there are legal actions that do not involve seeking to enforce a contract. Because why else would they have put those words in there? They could have very easily just dropped those three words altogether and said, the TCA applies to any legal action involving non-disparagement arising from an employment relationship. If that's what they intended, they could have said it. But they said those three words for a reason. And the Texas Supreme Court says every word in that statute has to have a meaning. So there's many different legal actions, actually, which do not seek to enforce a contract. One of those is Rule 202.
Well, I mean, there would be no purpose in doing a 202 petition if they didn't potentially see a lawsuit that's subsequent to that.
And obviously their argument is, yeah, they're just trying to get a deposition here, but once they get that deposition, then they're going to be able to decide whether or not they're going to be able to seek to enforce that contract. You agree with that piece at least?
I'm sorry, Justice Walker, but I do not necessarily agree with that either, because if you're following a Rule 202 under Texas to investigate, that doesn't mean you're necessarily, you have to be looking to file a lawsuit against somebody. You can do what they said in their petition here is, which is, I want to interrogate that person because I think they're going to have testimony that's harmful to my case somewhere else. So they don't have to say it on the face of the petition.
So do you think the legislature drafted and ratified 202 to give parties the ability to just investigate matters even if they don't anticipate litigation?
So I'll have to say I don't think the legislature drafted it. The Texas Supreme Court promulgates the rules. I can't tell you why they did it that way or all their reasons. All I can say is we look at the words and what the statute allow or what the rule allows. And I think when you say I'm going to allow you to investigate, it doesn't necessarily mean that, okay, I'm for sure going to bring a lawsuit after this or I have a lawsuit. It just says investigate. All you have to show under that rule, and we can pull out the language of it and look at it, you don't have to plead a cause of action. All you got to say is, I need the discovery to investigate, and the benefits outweigh the burdens and costs. That's all the statute says you have to do, or the rule, sorry, the rule. That's all the rule says you have to do. And if you want to look at it, I think I have it here, 202.4A2. But I don't necessarily want to dwell either on that. The point for, and I'll pause if you all do want to look at that.
I have no problem with you moving on.
Okay.
Personally. But.
So under Rule 202, to actually enforce, I mean, you can't enforce a contract. I said that, right? To enforce a contract, what do you got to do? You got to go file another petition in a new proceeding. You have to plead a cause of action, including damages. You have to pay another $350 filing fee. You have to get citation, and you have to get service, and then so on from there. That's when the process starts of enforcing a contract. It does not start at the point of, oh, I think somebody might have done something, so I want to investigate it. I mean, you could go all the way back to me sitting in my office when someone first calls me. I'm starting to investigate something there. I guess I'm filing a lawsuit now all of a sudden. So I don't think that their argument for how that, you know, the law enforcement and get investigations and all that stuff applies into all of a sudden now I'm enforcing a contract. The one thing I think that I noticed that it looked like he said that you all took note of was about cases referring to a Rule 202 as being ancillary to a suit, right? And I think sometimes what happens in case law I've seen anyway, when you trace it all the way back to where that language comes from, it's from a Rule 202 petition that's doing, the purpose was an anticipated suit. And they refer to it as, well, that's ancillary to the suit that you're going to do. And then cases after that pick up that language. They start just talking about Rule 202 in general, but they're not applying it necessarily to the investigation prong. And so I think it just kind of got taken out of context sometimes. The investigation prong is not ancillary to any suit. It doesn't have to be, is what I'm saying. So circle back to the other point I wanted to make, though, that I kind of started with, was that another dispositive one, I think, is that it's clear that they sought to do this discovery for reasons other than enforcing a non-disparagement provision. I think it's kind of clear when you read between the lines, to me, that was their primary purpose. The Seventh Court of Appeals in the Krauss Contractors case cited in my brief says, if you have anything in your Rule 202 discovery request that triggers the TCPA, then it triggers the TCPA, because that's what all your discovery is at issue. I think it's more than evident here that what they really wanted to do was get her under oath to testify and try to undermine this testimony that they think is bad for them in a different case. They said it in their petition. That's at paragraph 26 of the Rule 202. So that has nothing to do with enforcing non-disparagement. We're outside of the statute or the exemption right there as well.
Yeah, let me go back to your idea that it's not ancillary in the investigative prong. You know, the actual language is to investigate a potential claim or suit. I mean, that's some kind of claim or suit. It's the possibility of a claim or suit.
Right.
I mean, you, I don't think people would expend resources moving forward with a Rule 202 petition if they didn't think that they may get something out of it down the road. You agree with that much, correct?
Yes, but I still think this case is a prime example of where it doesn't have to be, I'm necessarily going to sue her. They're looking at getting her testimony for other purposes, which they said in their petition. We're going to use it because we're faced with other litigation outside of this, and we want to get her under oath and undermine that testimony.
And I think one of the things that you brought forward to the trial court and you mentioned in your briefs is essentially a concern that you have to protect her from being harassed in a roundabout way. But you never really put on any evidence that that's what they're in fact trying to do. That was just a concern that you had. Would you agree with that?
I'm sorry to keep disagreeing with you, Justice Walker, but I did put in declarations from her, from me, and there's also evidence from a Virginia case.
Well, I saw that, sure. But.
Where there was an affidavit from that person there who said the same things were happening to him. He's a former employee. He was accused of talking to CNBC, and all of a sudden he gets sued. So I think there is some evidence in the record of a harassment. If there's no other questions on the dispositive, or on the, sorry, the exemption, I'll just transition to the second step, which is that they haven't met their burden for a prima facie case under the TCPA. And the fact there, I think, is just an absence of evidence. So they offered zero evidence to start with on the cost of the burden. What they're telling you is, I put in a heavily redacted contract, I put in some news articles, and you know what? That's enough for everybody to just infer that the burden or that the benefit outweighs the burden and the cost here. That to me is just a complete lack of evidence. They haven't met their burden, especially when you look at the Texas Supreme Court, who is the one that creates these rules, right? So they're essentially the legislature for the purposes of these rules, and they've said many times, pre-suit discovery is supposed to be the exception and not the norm, because it's so easy to, especially on the investigation prong, to misuse it. And that's where you see the language where they're talking about forced interrogations and stuff like that. Those are all very strong words, right? And, you know, harassment and stuff like that. But I think it's there for a reason. And that's because they do not want this to be misused like it can be. But also when you look at what this court and others have said about how Rule 202 intersects with the TCPA, I think there's several guidelines that they give you as far as what is not sufficient as a matter of law. And so number one that jumped out to me, and it's in my brief too, is not only did they ask for a deposition here, they asked for document production. And you don't see them talking anything about document production in their opening brief or anything like that, and that's because it was exceptionally broad. They didn't say, like, oh, just, you know, give me any documents you have where you're talking to CNBC, if that's what they cared about, right? They said, give me everything to do with your affirmation. I want to know everyone you've talked about it. I want to know about attorneys you've talked to and stuff like that. Document requests under this court's prior precedent in DeAngelis are not allowed under Rule 202. I think there are other courts of appeals who say you can do that. But this court, its precedent is no, you can't do it. And so they asked for these broad document requests, and they have not backed up the, you know, the benefit and the versus the burden and cost for that whatsoever. They said nothing on that. So I think that right there, they haven't met their burden to start with. And the next thing is, courts have said, if you only make conclusory assertions that the benefit outweighs the burden and cost, then you fail to meet your standard. And that happened here. And I don't know if you picked up from my brief, but it was only actually months after the court denied their Rule 202 that they then put in this declaration from an attorney to say, okay, well, we're going to pay the cost for a court reporter, we're going to pay a videographer, and we're going to, you know, secure the location. That does nothing whatsoever to take away the burden, the cost and the burden for her, because she didn't have to pay for those things to start with. And I know that they've raised, I think in the reply brief, they said, well, we could have won, prevailed at some point later on and imposed those costs on her. Well, they never actually offered in the trial court even to say, we're not gonna do that. They just said, we're gonna do it up front. But I don't think it's true either that they could get those costs awarded even if they were to file a full lawsuit, because again, we've got two separate proceedings. You've got Rule 202 is its own proceeding. They have to pay their own costs under that. Once that proceeding is over with, those costs are gone. If they go file another lawsuit, they can't come back to the court and say, now from that other case, I want you to award costs against her in that case. So it still, to me, is just they have not put in any type of argument or evidence for the burden and cost on there. They're just doing the things that they have to do already to get depositions. Another thing on the prima facie burden, I think it was a court called NRA Krauss Landscape Contractors. They said if your own opinions and statements that there's less burden and cost here than there would be in a full lawsuit is really conclusory. It doesn't mean anything because, I mean, it's just their opinion, and it's just completely out of nowhere because you don't know what's going to happen in that next lawsuit. They may never file a lawsuit. They may file that lawsuit, and they may get dismissed immediately for a few different procedural reasons. And and then the court's decision in DeAngelis, I think I already raised the point where if they already know who did what and they pleaded almost a cause of action already in their case, this court said in that case, well, you don't need Rule 202 then. What's your purpose? What are you really trying to do here?
Well, I mean, there are situations where they could, where a party could be seeking to investigate something from a witness to find out what they know, which might not ever implicate that witness. So there could be a situation where a deposition could just on, that's just the way lawsuits work, Rule 202 could be more efficient than a lawsuit.
So it could be, I guess, more efficient for the petitioner, right? But that's not the only thing that's considered, I believe, under the rule, right? It's the burden and cost against the party who you're going to yank out of the blue 7 years later, who is just completely surprised to receive this, and you're going to make them take time off work. You're going to make them scared out of their wits because you're at one point you're saying, well, I want to investigate something for this other lawsuit, but I also might sue you for potentially millions of dollars. Who knows? They put in a CNBC article says that that CNBC article caused them to lose millions of dollars. We don't know what's going to happen. So,
are you saying that Bolero has said unequivocally that they know that she spoke to CNBC?
So I'm not telling you what they said. I'm just telling you what's in their petition. And I can point you to, it's the court record, page 8, paragraph 17 of their petition. It says, Ms. Frisbee's recent voluntary disclosure of the assertions in her affirmation is a clear violation of the non-disparagement obligations in her separation agreement. They pled that she breached right there.
Yeah. But that doesn't say that she communicated that to CNBC. And of course, that's the question they're saying that they don't know the answer to.
That's what they're saying.
Yeah.
So I think I'm out of time.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to respond to a couple of the points made from the podium, but I would just note for the court two things that you did not hear in my colleague's presentation. First of all, I don't think I heard rational inference anywhere, which is the standard here. It's not whether this court thinks the benefits outweigh the burdens. It's whether a jurist could draw a rational inference of that. I think it's more or less whether if we had won below, this court would order mandamus relief because it was just an arbitrary grant of a 202 petition based on what we presented. And I don't think that standard's satisfied, and I didn't actually hear that. The other thing I haven't heard or read in many pages of briefing is what more we could have provided on the burden. The burdens she came forward with are idiosyncratic burdens about the way she feels about a deposition, and I don't cast any doubt on that. But as the Rule 202 petitioner, we couldn't present evidence of how she feels. The burdens are generally the burdens associated with any deposition. I'm not sure what else we could have provided, and my colleague has never actually given an example of something we could have put in about her burden other than what everybody knows.
I think it was Justice Wallach who raised the question about why not just depose her as a third-party witness in that other lawsuit that's going on?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, and I'm speaking a little outside the record, but certainly at the time the record closed in this case, there was no pending lawsuit. I think what he's referring to is a demand letter that this guy, Mr. Dow, this attorney, Mr. Dow, sent to us a couple weeks after the CNBC article. To my knowledge, again, speaking outside the record, I could be wrong, but to my knowledge, there is no pending lawsuit. So the cases from other courts of appeals, and I think even maybe DeAngelis, about, well, why don't you just go to the pending lawsuit, they don't apply here because there is no pending lawsuit.
And I think that's actually in the record. I think it's in the record that case was already disposed of.
Oh, I'm sorry. So there's another case. There's the case with the affirmation. That was back in 2017. Okay. That was long since disposed of. Then there's this more recent demand letter from the same lawyer. But as far as I know, there's no pending action.
What about the issue of all the cost and expense and inconvenience of looking for and pulling records that you asked for, assuming that you were entitled to get them?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that record request was actually as broad as my colleague portrays it. So this is at page 9 of the clerk's record, paragraph 24 of our petition. It's documents or communications in her possession, custody, or control concerning the assertions in the affirmation and communications discussed with any third parties, it's listing CNBC and Mr. Dow, concerning the affirmation or other matters related to Bolero or AMF. If she wanted to come forward and say, I have this huge wealth of documents as an ordinary person, and I'm going to have to get a document third party to do searches of my servers, I think in the ordinary course, parties would negotiate that and say, wait a minute, we really just want the stuff about disparagement. We don't need everything in the world. She claims that she's had no communications with third parties. So if that's true, I don't actually think this document request in practice would be that broad. But I think in the ordinary course, if the court thought the deposition was fine, or at least you could draw a rational inference that way, but the document request was too broad, the court would say, hey, I'm not granting the document request, deposition, go ahead. I don't think that makes this a meritless petition within the meaning of the TCPA, such that fee shifting is appropriate if they just thought the document request was too broad. I want to respond to the point that, well, we already know she did it. It's true that in our petition there are some statements that are probably a bit more declaratory than they should have been, but just as we can't prevail on a 202 petition based on an assertion in a verified petition, I don't think we lose because of that. I think the question is whether the evidence we brought forward, which primarily consists of the contract, the affirmation, and the news articles, are sufficient to show we have a genuine investigative need, but we don't know for sure. And I think the evidence falls right in that heartland. We don't know she's the one that transmitted it, but since it's her statements, there's at least a question whether she was involved in that. So I think we satisfy that. Just trying to look at my notes and what he said. Oh, my colleague said that the principle that a 202 petition is ancillary to the anticipated suit does not apply to 202 petitions under the investigative prong. Again, I would just point the court to the Texas Supreme Court's decision in DePino. It recited precisely that principle, and in the first paragraph of the case, it says this is a 202 petition under the investigative prong. The last point I would make is I come back to the court's question about DeAngelis and whether it should reconsider the question of legal action and whether a 202 petition is a legal action. My colleague said we didn't raise that below. That's true. As the court knows, it would have been futile to raise it below. A trial court cannot overrule a decision of this court. I don't think that would ordinarily be considered a waiver to not raise a futile argument, but even if it were this court interested in reconsidering that precedent, I think it has full discretion sua sponte to reconsider that precedent, and we'd urge the court to do so for the reasons I said. A deposition is not legal or equitable relief. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The oral argument has been very, very helpful. We appreciate you being here and answering our questions, and with that, your case is submitted. Thank you.
All rise.